Again, this whole Power Talk program is really designed to give people strategies for lifelong success. And that's basically what you've been doing for the last 15 years or more, is teaching people fundamentals they can use right away. You've probably done it better than almost anyone I know. And it's really a privilege to have you here.
It's great to be with you, Tony.
I'm really excited to share with you people a little bit about your background. What's made you successful as a person? You're probably one of the most successful, if not the most successful, business authors in the country. I'd like to talk a little bit about the One Minute Manager Meets the Monkey, probably my favorite out of the group, which is hard to say since I've enjoyed them all so much. But I think what I'd like to start with most of all is just to get an idea from you. A lot of people, when they hear the One Minute Manager, they think, well, business, or they think, well, I'm not a manager as a businessman, or that's not part of my career. But I really believe that everyone is a manager. We're managing our time, we're managing our emotions, we're managing our family. And so I'd be curious, what's your definition of a manager and who is a manager?
Well, Tony, I think once you decide to be a manager, it really means that you are going to work and help other people. I think the difference between a manager and anybody else is individual contributors have a job that they might do or a responsibility, but they don't have anybody else that they necessarily have to worry about. And so as a parent, you're managing kids if you have kids, and as a manager, you have people, and it's a whole different thing. A lot of times we make a mistake in organizations, and we take good doers and make them managers and assume that they're going to be a good manager. That's not necessarily true.
The Peter principle.
That's right. And so managing is saying, I'm going to spend my time trying to help other people win. As an individual contributor, you're responsible for your own winning.
What makes a really great manager from your standpoint?
Well, I think the real key, and I just took a trip with my two kids and my wife, Margie, we went to 18 countries over 3 months last fall, and it's so clear as you see what's happening in the Eastern Bloc and as you see what's happening all over the world, that human dignity is more important than ever. People have come almost with a giant spirit pulling us together now to say, I want to be treated as if I'm important, as if I can think, as if I can make decisions. And my feeling about management now is that your job is to empower your people so that they can make decisions that will be in their best interest and the best interest of the organization. And I, for a long time, have said the most important part of being a manager is not what happens when you're there, it's what happens when you're not there. And so the whole process of empowerment is how do you gradually help people to the point where they think that they psychologically own the company, they psychologically own the organization, and they're going to make decisions that are just as good as if you made them. And I think people want that kind of responsibility. I think we have to be careful that we manage the journey to get there. Don't just assume that people are there and then just turn it over. I think that's a major problem around the world. How do we throw off autocratic leadership and then move to a democratic without some transition? I think we need to look at that in our foreign policy and our organizations. How do you bring people along so that they can eventually really feel their own power?
I think it's really important for people to realize then that, as you said, even if a person, if you have somebody's a friend, you're a manager in essence. You're managing the relationship, you're supporting the person, you're taking an interest in them. And how to make that transition you're talking about, you know, from having somebody controlling us to controlling our own destiny requires managing ourselves. The transition, though, isn't that really what you taught in leadership styles? Isn't that in essence what you were teaching there?
That really is, Tony. It's a whole movement from a directing leadership style where you're telling people what to do, how to do it, where to do it, and closely supervising them. And you gradually move from directing to coaching where you're still directing, but there's two-way communication, to supporting where you're basically involving them in decision-making, to delegating where you let them run with the ball. And I kind of think of the movement from directing to coaching to supporting to delegating. It's like a railroad track. And that if you want to get to the point where people are really empowered and you can delegate to them, you got to stay on the railroad track. The biggest problem with parents and managers is that we tell people what to do, we give them our best advice, and then we disappear only to return when they've screwed up enough that it's noticeable. So we go from directing to delegating,
right.
And there's no railroad track there. And anytime you get off the track, then people get hurt. and you end up with what we call leave alone zap or seagull management. Seagull managers kind of fly in, make a lot of noise, dump on everybody, and then fly out. So it's just a real process. And the 1 minute manager itself really showed the key steps in that process, because when you're going to teach somebody and try to move them along, I have always found that there's 5 steps to teaching people. First, you tell them what to do. Then you show them what to do. You kind of model it. Then you let them try. And then fourth, you observe performance. That's the one that often people miss, the observe performance.
Right.
And the reason you observe performance, so you can do the fifth step, which is either praise progress or redirect. And it sometimes is praise progress and redirect. It's
right.
Very important that you underline the word progress, because what you're trying to do as you manage the journey is to catch people doing things approximately right rather than exactly right. Exactly right comes when you can feel you could delegate and they're really empowered. And so it's a really constant process. And if when you observe there's no progress, then you can stop and go back to tell and show. And tell and show is really the first secret of the 1 minute manager, 1 minute goal setting. If you want somebody to do something, you got to be clear on what you want them to do and what good behavior looks like, which is tell and show. And then the praising progress has to do with the second secret of the 1 minute manager, which is 1 minute praising, which is after people are clear what you want them to do, you want to see if you can catch them doing anything right so you can pat them on the back.
Right.
And then the third secret of the 1 minute manager that Spencer Johnson and I did was the 1 minute reprimand, which is something that's saved only for good performers. With a learner, you don't reprimand them. If you can't praise progress, you redirect so
right.
you can get them back on. If you punish a learner, you will immobilize them. But a reprimand's appropriate sometimes with somebody who it's a won't do problem, not a can't do,
right.
where it's an attitude problem. But it's very important with a reprimand that you tell them as soon as possible what they did wrong and specifically what they did wrong, and then how you feel about it. I'm angry, I'm upset, I'm disappointed, I'm frustrated, whatever you are. But then you have to end with a reaffirmation which says to the person, you know, the reason I'm angry, the reason I'm upset is that you're better than this. This is so unlike you. And it's very important to separate out people from their behavior. People are beautiful. It's just their behavior is a problem sometimes. And what often happens when we get angry or disappointed or upset with people, we go for their jugular and we attack them as
right.
a human being. You idiot, how could you do this? And what happens is you lose your whole effectiveness with them, because now their energy goes to looking at your leadership style and are analyzing you rather than owning the fact that they maybe did something that wasn't appropriate. Where if you leave the person intact but zero in on the behavior, they can then own that, because their okayness is not up for grabs. It's just that behavior that they need to work on.
They don't have to defend so much. If
That's
you attack
right.
the person, then now the self-esteem is on the line,
mm-hmm.
versus if you attack the problem or a behavior, they can disassociate themselves from that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, how would you relate this and how have you related this to managing your relationship with your own kids?
Well, you know, one of the neat things about the 1 minute manager is it was so easy to read. And so Scott and Debbie got a chance because the book came out.
Here's what you did to us, huh, Dad?
Well, they laughed and got a kick, and we used that. But we were always trying to use those things. I think where I always fell down on probably was the reprimand. You know, I'm a positive person. I always try to catch them doing something right. But Marge and I used to have a strategy, because we were both not willing to discipline them necessary when, as we would say, it's your turn, you know, it's my turn. And
pass the buck.
It's fun now that the kids are 22 and 24, too, to really get to know them as human beings and as friends, and to see maybe some of the stuff worked.
That's right.
But I know we were constantly working on trying to catch them doing something right and support them on their journeys.
What do you think you got the optimism that really guides your life? You know, you have this incredible warmth that you have for people. You know, I call you a teddy bear, and I mm-hmm. think most people feel about that way. You have so much love for people. And where do you think that comes from in your own background?
Well, I think it has to come from my mom and dad. My mom, who's 86 now, is one of the great people that I've ever met in my life. And she said that I laughed before I cried. I sang before I spoke. I danced before I walked. And she said, I can't take any credit. You kind of came out that way. But she's such a positive person. All of her friends are in the 40s and 50s because they love to go places with her because she's such an exciting person. And my dad was a career Navy man and was kind of a Mr. Roberts character and had one of the greatest sense of humors and was a really neat person. He died in 1979, and I really miss him. He was a wonderful example to me. So the two of them, I think, played a major role, and maybe something happened in the genes or something. But I've always thought life was really just a gas and really can't believe that I got a chance to do it.
How great. What do you think makes you as successful as you are as a writer and as a speaker? You've managed to become a master in both areas.
Well, it's really interesting about writing. I never thought I would be a writer. All the feedback I ever got when I was in school all the way through college was that my writing wasn't academic enough, which is I learned later you could understand it. And that I've never had a huge vocabulary and always love to learn from people who make complicated things simple. And so after so many years in school, you know, going through 9 or 10 years to get a doctor's degree, I saw a lot of bad teachers, and I always decided that I was going to have a lot of fun if I ever got a chance to teach. But when my first job, I went as a college administrator because I never thought I could talk because of the writing, you know. And I just, by happen chance, my first teaching job came when the dean, Harry Everett, at Ohio University, when I went to be his assistant dean, said, I want all my deans to teach at least one course. And I had never thought about it. And I went into the class and just fell in love with it and the students, and we just had a marvelous time. And so within 2 years, Harry knew that I was a better teacher than an administrator. So I think that my success as a writer and as a speaker is that I really try to see if I can get the BS out of the behavioral sciences and make things simple to understand, because that's the only way I can understand them. And
you make it fun also.
Yeah, and I got that, I think, from my dad and mom, you know, about the sense of humor and that life is serious but not that serious. And
yeah.
That if you can laugh as much as you cry, you can make it through life.
What a great strategy. That one has some take-home value, I think, for anybody for a lifetime. Simple and powerful. You shared with me one time about when you were teaching about how you gave tests and you had a rather unique approach to them that's consistent with the One-Minute Manager. I wish you'd share that with us.
Well, my whole philosophy, and I used to get in trouble with other faculty, was that you want the students to win. So I gave the final exam out the first day of class, and the rest of the faculty would say, what are you doing? And I'd say, I'm confused. And they'd say, you act it. And I said, I thought, so I was supposed to teach these kids. You are, but don't give them the questions in the final. And I would say, not only am I going to give them the questions in the final, but what do you think I'm going to do all semester? I'm going to teach them the answers.
What a concept.
The interesting thing about that, Tony, is that you can give a lot harder exams that way, see? Because a lot of people say, well, that's soft management. It isn't, because I used to challenge professors, you know, if you didn't like what I was doing, I'm willing to test my students against any students in my field in terms of their knowledge. And they would always back off because I taught the students what they should know and then taught them all the answers. And so what it really is, it's that whole thing around empowerment, because my feeling is that the normal distribution mentality towards the world says that as a manager, my job is to judge, criticize, and rank order and all that, rather than to cheerlead, support, encourage, and that kind of thing. So that it's not about games, it's about up front. And giving the exam right away is about as clear a goals as you can give. This is what I want you to learn, and we're going to do this. And it wasn't true, false, multiple choice. There was some really hard stuff. But then everybody knew that you were on their side, and then they really can get excited about it. So that's what I think the managers really have to get, is that after the goals are set and you play a major role there, then your job is really to be the servant leader, which is what can I do to help you accomplish those goals? And it's my job to help you win, not my job to sit back and evaluate you. I evaluate you, sure, on a day-to-day basis, only so that I can coach you
and support
to get better.
Well, the phrase, if you wish to become great, learn to become the servant of many, comes to mind, certainly as a foundation.
Well, you know, I've always been struck, Jesus, as a religious leader, when you think it, he really hired 12 deadbeats. the only guy who had any education was Judas. And he built quite a management team. And much of what I teach is in the Bible because people said to him, how do I become first? He said, by being last.
Yeah.
You know, how do I lead? By follow. And that whole philosophy of serving others and helping them become the very best. And I think that's the whole philosophy.
What would be your definition of empowerment?
I think empowerment is when you can help people get the skills and confidence that they can handle almost any problem, any situation that comes their way in a particular job or activity, and that they really feel that they have the power rather than you.
Right.
And that really gets to be powerful because then you're freed up to do all kinds of other things rather than looking over people's shoulders. And when people identify with the organization and feel that you have given them the skills and the confidence to make decisions, they're going to make better decisions than you could from a distance, and they're also going to own it. And then you're going to have people really hooked because they really feel part of it.
Yeah, they'll have the self-esteem and the growth that comes with it. What I find is that many times people give them the skills, but they don't give them the confidence. They don't give them really the ability to make those decisions, whether it be their children or whether it be in their business. And I think you're right, it has to be a combination of the two. Also, sometimes people give people confidence but no skills, and then you've got a real challenge on your hand. Mm-hmm. You've got somebody who's all excited and positive and hepped up, but they don't know what to do, so you've got some challenges. How did the One Minute Manager first come to be? What was the story behind that?
Well, Tony, I think life in many ways is what happens to you when you're planning on doing something else. And I was out here on a sabbatical leave in 1976 and was planning to go back to Massachusetts. And we ran into a group called the Young Presidents Organization, YPO, and they kind of adopted us and said to Marge and I, you ought to start your own organization. And we didn't know anything about building a business, and they helped us. And just created possibility thinking. That's one of the things I love in California. Somewhat back east, people ask why. Out here, they really do ask why not.
Right.
And so when we started our own company and our own business, we just started feeling, what couldn't we do? I mean, we really had great potential. And Marge and I were invited to a cocktail party for authors by Adelaide Bree, who was a wonderful author herself. And Spencer Johnson happened to be there, and Spencer was an MD who had got interested in writing children's books and wrote some marvelous books called Value Tales that even outsold Dr. Seuss for a while. And Spencer was working on a book called The 1 Minute Parent or The 1 Minute Scolding on working with kids, and Marge kind of hand-carried him over to me and said, you all ought to talk, what we maybe need is a children's book for managers. And Spencer and I started talking, and he had been working with Jerry Nelson on a book on scolding, disciplining, but he had already expanded his own mind to parenting and all. And I was talked to him about the importance of goal setting and praising, and
right.
Spencer had already been thinking about some of that. And I invited him to a seminar that I was giving at the Rancho Bernardo Inn in San Diego on Monday, and Spencer and Adelaide came up and sat in the back, and Spencer laughed and enjoyed and all. And at the end of the day, he came up and said, "The hell with parenting, let's go for managers." And
which parents are.
That's right. And so the synergy was absolutely incredible. In fact, in many ways, the One Minute Manager wrote us. I think it really needed to be out. And from meeting in early November, we had our own self-published version out by the 1st of May, which we presented at the National Restaurant Association in Chicago, and and sold 15 or 20,000 copies on our own with really no advertising.
Wow.
And you know, tremendous energy. And then Spencer and Margaret McBride, who's been our literary agent and friend, went to New York and talked to publishers who all were going crazy. But they all said, you know, you can't sell a small book for $15 because the woman, a manager, is very small. In fact, Spencer had spent some time looking at nonfiction books and found out that less than 10% of all the nonfiction books bought in America are ever read past the first chapter. And in fact,
amazing.
You buy them and you put them in your shelves. And
they look good.
And all, yeah. And so we decided to make our book only one chapter long. So it just, William Morrow took the challenge of how do you sell a little book. And it was just one of those energy things that the timing was right. And within probably 3 weeks, it was on the bestseller list and just hung in there for 3 years. And
that's amazing.
So it was a wonderful experience. And still amazing how many it still sells and how many letters I still get from people about that book.
It's been sold over 7 million copies now or something like
that? I guess so, in terms of paperback and foreign. And
amazing, amazing. Yeah. Around the world. One of the questions that comes up for people is, why the high price on such a small book? What was the philosophy behind it?
The philosophy behind that was, is if it was a $5.95 book, they would think it was in the $5.95 idea. And that we put a seal on the front that said small, expensive, but invaluable. And so it was a whole strategy to say, yeah, it was small, but there's some gems that can really make a difference in your life and step up to it and go for it. And I think it changed the whole nonfiction book publishing in this country when people started pricing things on value rather than necessarily size, which had been the only way it was done before.
That's interesting. And when you talk about value versus cost, what do you consider the value of distinctions, strategies, and so forth? How important are they to success?
Well, I think that what people need is just a couple of good ideas to take them to the next plateau. And I think that if you're a positive thinker and you have a vision of where you want to go, ideas and people will come towards you. And rather than looking for some complicated thing to make a difference, everything I've ever seen is a few simple ideas can make that breakthrough to go to the next level that can open you up for the next few thoughts that can move you. And I think that what we were trying to do is to say what was the essence of management, and if you could set real clear goals, and if you could catch people doing things right and praise them, and if you could reprimand people when they got off of track in a way that didn't make them feel lousy about themselves but made them change their behavior, there's not too many other things that, from the people standpoint, you need. So what you're trying to do is increase people's behavioral batting average by giving her a concept. You know, I think the old economist Pareto in Italy had something. He talked about the 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of sales comes from 20% of your salespeople and 80% of this. And I'm not sure that it's those good 20% ideas that make most of the gains for you, not the big complicated things that are all-encompassing.
Yeah. The whole purpose of Power Talk is to give people a series of those strategies so they can count on them, some gems that'll trigger them. What would you say are two or three of the most important distinctions or strategies that have really shaped your life, say, in the last 2 or 3 years?
Well, I think probably the most important one is the whole concept of commitment. And I first got that from Werner Erhard and Est. And Art Turok, who's a friend who wrote a book called Getting Physical, took that and built on it and said that there's a difference between commitment and interest. And that is a really important distinction for me, is that interested people, whether you're interested in losing weight, whether you're interested in making money or whatever you're interested in, is if you're just interested in it, you will always have an excuse why you can't do it. Where committed people don't know about excuses, they just know about results. And I remember asking Werner one time, you know, what's his definition of commitment? He said that commitment is when you live as if your word is you, and you said you were going to do it, and now you're going to really go for it. And where an interested exerciser wakes up in the morning and it's raining, and they say, gee, it's raining out, I think I'll exercise tomorrow. Where a committed exerciser wakes up and says, it's raining out, I think I'll get my rain gear. So what it's also helped me is to realize that you don't want to be committed to everything. It's okay to be interested in some things.
Pretty important distinction.
Yeah. But don't put yourself down if you don't become a super high achiever in those interested areas. In fact, I don't think, and it gets back to goal setting, that you can concentrate on any more than two or three really significant things, say, in a year or a period of time. And so a lot of times people want to do everything at once, and you just can't. All the peak performers I know focus and have a few things that they're really going to go at no matter what.
Right. An absolute commitment. I call that concentration of power. Mm-hmm. That if you concentrate all your power on anything every single day and you've got to demand more from yourself every day to become more, mm-hmm. you're going to get great in that area. But the challenge is that most people, from my perception, never concentrate their power. They've got 8 million things they're trying to do simultaneously, or they major in minor things.
That's right.
They do things that really don't matter, and they focus on those on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about commitment, I've certainly found in my own relationship that that's probably the essence of a quality relationship. How's that affected your marriage? You've been married now how many years?
28 years now.
Wow. Incredible lady who loves you, and you obviously love tremendously.
Yeah.
How has that played a role there?
Well, I think that a lot of times people look at the marriage vows as to death do us part if it's convenient. And that, a lot of people ask me, whether I do marriage counseling. And I say, I don't know marriage counseling, but I'll ask you one question. Do you want your relationship to work? And there's only two answers, yes or no. And not while we're trying. Trying, as you know, is this a noisier way of not doing something. In fact, I have a lot of friends that periodically go into marriage counseling, and I'll always say, why are you doing it? If they say, well, we're trying to get our relationship, I say, save your money. You're either going to go to make it work or go right. to get a friendly separation. So I think that Marge and I, as we grew together, came to a point, and I think it probably was the transition from moving from Massachusetts to California. She had just finished her doctorate and, was really solid in her background in education. And we came to the point where we really didn't need each other. Because she had her own power and her own degree and her own field that she could have gone. And then we said, well, do we want to be together?
Yeah.
And I think that's really powerful because then you say yes. And that's what commitment is all about. When you say, yes, I want to make it work, now what you do is you accent the positive and you try to catch that person doing something right. What happens in a lot of love relationships is, when they say love is blind, they're really saying all you're doing is noticing the positive. And so all love relationships, as well as work relationships, all start off positive. And then all of a sudden you have some permanency and you say, gee, I didn't know about that. Who told me about that? And what's the final demise of a love relationship is when you do something right, you get yelled at because you didn't do it right enough. You should have asked me. You should have done it on Wednesday. And if you want to catch people doing things wrong, you can. That's why the only sure. question to ask is, do you want to make it work or not? So Marge and I are just growing and having a ball together, looking forward to the next 40 or 50 years together. But we came to the point to say, hey, we're going to accent the positive, because who doesn't have behaviors that bug somebody? And it's amazing, though, if you're in a supportive environment and people feel that you're on their side, they'll also work on some of the things that probably bug you.
Yeah.
But if all you accent is the negative and what the problem is, then they can never get past it.
And you've taken away their opportunity to try and give to you as well, because now you're demanding them versus allowing them to have the opportunity of giving you the gift. What do you value most in your life? I know you value a lot of things that are really important to you, but what would you say you value most?
Well, Marge and I went through a process as we were thinking into our company, and our company is very much like us. And the number one is relationships. We said that our most important thing is our relationships, whether they be 40-year-old relationships or 1-week relationships, is that if we say to somebody that we're committed or we want to do something, we want to really take care of that relationship, even if it costs us money or other kinds of things. And that's been one that we have kept on shouting out in our own company, that our relationship with our customers, our relationship with each other, and all that's the most important value. And I think that as Marge and I move on in our lives, that what we come back to more time and time again is people and the relationships. I love Rabbi Kushner, who wrote "When Bad Things Happen to Good People," and I really enjoyed his book "When All You Ever Wanted Is Not Enough." And he was on a conference with Marge and I, and he said all of his years as a rabbi, he never heard anybody in their deathbed to say, "I wish I went to the office more." They all said, "I wish I had loved more. I wish I had reached out more." And so I feel good that we've come to that feeling way before, you know, our last moments to say, "Yeah, they're really important." And so I think that's what drives us.
How do you nurture your relationships? You seem to, I know. Recently, when I got a chance to meet quite a few of your friends at your birthday party, you've got friends that you've known for 20, 30 years or more. And the closeness that you guys have is not like they just came and showed up because it was a birthday. That mm-hmm. closeness is obviously constant. What gives you the ability, what strategies or talents do you think you have that cause you to be able to nurture relationships so well?
Well, I think to really nurture relationships, whether they be in your own immediate family or external, is that you have to be willing to go and do things together, experience things together. I think just having a meal every once in a while is nice, but where you want to get past that is that going skiing together, camping together, doing something together. And our oldest and dearest friends are ones that we continually meet and do things with, where we're kind of with each other for 24 hours and exposing each other to all of us who we are. And Marge and I just have taken time out over the years. We had a marvelous thing that Marge's mom and dad had set up. They had a little cottage that they started with a tent on and finally built a little cottage in upstate New York in Skinny Atlas. And so ever since I've known Marge, we just go there for 6 or 7 weeks in the summer, and people just gather there. And that's another place where friends gather, where we all cook the meals together and clean together and fish together and boat together and play together. And that's just been part of our lives. Even when we started a company, we said from the first employee, you know, we're gone. Yeah. 6 or 7 weeks, that's where our roots are. And so I think it takes time, that your relationships are a goal. It's not just something that you kind of fit in on the side. I mean, when I look at my goals, there's a whole category on relationships that I look at every week and see if there's somebody I might be near this week, or is there somebody I could call, or is there something that I can do to reach out to people that are important.
We all tend to get what we focus on, and mm-hmm. because you value relationships so much, you've focused on it and you've made them better and better constantly. I'm curious, what do you think makes the biggest difference in the quality of people's lives? If there was a distinction that you think sets people apart, what would you say it is?
Well, I have a feeling that what really makes a difference in your quality of life is that you have a sense of who you are and where you're going, and you make strides towards that. Spencer Johnson and I, when we wrote The 1 Minute Manager, said that people who feel good about themselves produce good results. And that's really true. When you feel good about yourself, you do things better. But when I wrote Putting the 1 Minute Manager to Work with Bob Lauber, I changed that because I really realized that just trying to make people feel good in a vacuum doesn't really work. One of the differences between us and other animals is that we're purposeful. And that doesn't mean that other animals aren't. We were in a safari for 3 weeks, and their purpose basically is to eat and survive. And so, yeah. But we can actually think of purposes beyond our own well-being. And so in Putting the 1 Minute Manager to Work, we changed the quote and said, people who produce good results feel good about themselves. And my sense is that people who get some sense of what they want to do, and then they go do it. And this doesn't mean that it has to be a business goal, it has to be an athletic goal, and all can be a relationships goal, it can be, but that you are purposeful about it, and then you go, wow, I made it, you know?
Right.
And you get a chance to really say, I did that, and I accomplished it, and I said I was going to do it. And so a friend of mine, Rick Tate, first gave me the quote, feedback is the breakfast of champions. And I think that the most contented people I know are constantly getting feedback on how well they're doing in relation to what's important to them. And so I think we all have to set our goals and our visions in relation to what we have chosen as our role in life. But just sitting around, you know, complaining or thinking things are going to come your way is not the way to do it. I think it's purposeful.
And sometimes you're not going to get the feedback automatically, obviously. I think a lot of people are winning, but they feel like they're losing because they're not keeping score. You know, they have no measurement tool, as you say. How do you measure your progress in various areas of your life?
Well, what I try to do in the beginning of the year is say, okay, it's a year from now. What might I have accomplished? And I break those into different categories, like relationships, like my own spirituality, like my health, like my writing goals, and then my goals with our company and things like that, and look at, say, okay, what would I feel really good about at the end of the year that I would accomplish in several of these areas? And some years I focus more on one area than another, but I kind of have a sense of family, friends, health, spirituality, writing, business, and that kind of thing, and then say, okay, where am I heading this year, and how well can I do that? And I feel best when I constantly monitor and keep track of that. And when I don't, which I have had lapses where, you know, I've been so caught up in doing that I forgot what the whole thing was about, you know, when your life kind of gets out of whack. I think we all really teach what we need to learn, you know. So I constantly am on my feet talking to people about getting their life in order and setting their priorities and things like that, because that's what something I need to do.
And I can relate.
But I think that one of the things that keeps us up, and I consider you and I up people, is that we're constantly wanting to learn. And I was just amazed at that when I got a chance to work with Norman Vincent Peale. And so I figured we got years to go if we have that. And I think that's what keeps my mom at 86 going. You know, I come home after I've been on a trip and she has a folder for me of things that she's read that she thinks I should know about and that kind of thing. And it's just great.
That's great. I got a chance to hear Norman speak. And he was a gem. I know he's been a role model for you.
Terrific, yeah.
And me as well. Let me ask you about The One-Minute Manager Meets the Monkey. I've read all your books, and I love them all. But I have to say, I think this one may be your best, at least for me. We all judge things by what we need most. So I'm one of those crazy persons you described who's out there trying to do everything at once. And this was absolutely phenomenal. I'm curious, can you give us some background on where the original concept came from? And what motivated you personally to want to write this book in particular?
Well, the concept of the monkey really came from Bill Onken, who's one of the co-authors, and Hal Burrows, who's been a longtime presenter of Bill's material. And I met Bill in 1977, and he had written an article in the 1970s for the Harvard Business Review called Managing Management Time, Who Owns the Monkey?, which is one of the most widely read articles ever written. And when I read that, I mean, it really got to me. And so when I got a chance to meet Bill, it was just one of those great joys. Bill unfortunately died about a year ago at 75 and was one of the great inspirations to me. He went to Princeton. I always kidded him. I went to Cornell. And I always said Bill never got over it that he went to Princeton. But he had a physics degree at Princeton and no other degrees. And he spent 25 or 30 years working for different government agencies and different kinds of companies. And he was just an astute observer of what was going on. And so in the 1960s, he started doing seminars on managing management time, which he was saying is that before you can talk as a manager about managing your time, you have to have some time. and so he said all these techniques about, you know, overcoming time wasters and all those
right.
are only good if you have any time. And he watched what happened to people as managers. And one of the biggest ones was his whole, which he started, the monkey on the back analogy, which is a monkey really essentially is somebody else's problem. Bill really defined it as the next move. And anytime somebody comes to you and says, Tony, we have a problem, you better watch out because the monkey is about ready to leap, usually because you know enough about it to know it's a problem, but maybe not enough to solve it right then. And so you say to me, Ken, I know what you're talking about. I'll get back to you. See, now I walk out 30 pounds lighter because you've got the next move. And Bill said that monkeys have to either be shot or fed. And if you don't shoot them, you're into care and feeding. And if you're care and feeding one of my problems, then who's working for whom? You're working for me. And like any good supervisor, I'm back in your office or I call you on the phone. See, now I have you under pressure to do my job. And what's a problem with that is you are making me dependent on you. And people who take other people's monkeys are very subtle, and they don't even know what they're doing. But what you're really doing is crippling other people. Bill told me, you know, I was a typical Eastern do-gooder, you know,
right.
and I wanted to, you know, stomp out pain and all that.
Solve everybody else's problem for them.
Yeah, I was running around, you know, rescuing everybody. And so the monkey on the back concept is just such a beautiful analogy. And when people started hearing Bill talk about it, it became kind of legendary. And so I was motivated to write this book with Bill and Hal because I think it's such a marvelous concept and I wanted it to get as wide an audience as possible. And then when Bill passed away, I wanted more than ever to make sure that his work was not lost by any means. I love this book. I think that it hits people more than any because I think we all tend to run around with a lot of monkeys on our back that aren't ours. And it's not a cold approach, meaning to say, hey, that's your monkey, you keep it. It's not that you're abdicating or you're just buck passing and all. What the book does marvelously is to say, like we were saying in the beginning, is how do I eventually get you to the point where you can care and feed your own monkeys? And so it's, I'm not going to take your monkey away, but I'll help you learn how to care and feed it because that is where you get empowered. That's where you really get excited. And Bill has four rules of monkey management that are just absolutely so terrific that if you would use these in any kind of relationship.
When you're talking about the monkey, you're not really just talking about a problem, but what you're really talking about is the next move in the problem, right?
That's right.
And I think it's important. So if I come along to you, Ken, and I say, Ken, I got this problem, first thing Ken Blanchard wants to do, being the kind of guy he is who cares about people, is help me solve my problem. But if, in fact, you try and do that and it doesn't finish here, then you've left with my monkey. Is that what you're basically saying?
Yes, and if I say, well, I know what you're talking about, Tony. You know, let me call so-and-so. Now, sometimes that's appropriate and all, but if you have a tendency to always get the next moves with you and everybody's sitting waiting for you to make the next move, now you're creating a bunch of dependent people who are calling and checking up whether you've made the move for them rather than saying, yeah, I know what you understand. You know, somebody you ought to get in contact with is so-and-so. Let me give you their number and give you an entree to get them. Now you learn something from that and all, and I'm not owning the whole thing.
And you've given me the muscles, because if you do the exercise for me, I'm going to feel pretty weak.
That's right.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but what are the four rules then?
Well, the four rules of monkey management is before you break a meeting with an individual or a group, you have to first of all decide what's the next move. So that if you and I are discussing something and we end that discussion, we want to make sure we don't drop that until we know who's got the next move, what's going to be done on this. The second key thing in the rules is that we need to establish who owns the monkey. it's not always the person next to makes the next move that owns it, but ownership is very important because people will take better care of what they own. And so you might say, can I own this one? But you could really help me if you take this next move. But it's really clear that you own it, and I'm only making one move.
So I know
for
I'm responsible.
That you're responsible.
The monkey's going to stay on my back as long as I know I'm the owner.
That's right.
Okay.
And the third rule is that before we part company, we need to decide what insurance policy this monkey is going to have, depending on your nervousness or my nervousness. And the two rules of insurance are, one is recommend, then act. And that's for when you're concerned about what I might do.
Right.
And so now I can't burn the building down without you first knowing about it. Now, if I'm not nervous and I think you've grown to the point where you can run with a ball yourself, I can go to act, then advise. But we need to decide what the insurance policy is, because what so often happens with parenting and in managing, you say, I didn't tell you you could do that. You know, I mean, who told you could do? And you're doing self-analysis. I mean, after post-game analysis is what you're doing.
Right.
And so you want to make sure what insurance policy there
is. Now, when you say insure it, what do you mean by that, actually? Are you're saying insuring the monkey's being handled?
Well, it's really saying is, what coverage do I want? Do I want close supervision or do I want general supervision? And if I say, bring me a recommendation before you act, I want an insurance policy that's pretty tight because I don't want anything to happen that's a surprise. Where the other, I'm much looser.
I think a lot of people probably don't give up the monkeys. They're holding everybody else's monkey because they're afraid. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing then with the insurance policy is giving them the opportunity to really give the monkey away but still be able to direct and manage effectively.
Yeah, and sometimes the next move might be, why don't you think it over and then bring me a recommendation tomorrow?
Right.
See, and now I know that you're not going to run off and do something because you have that insurance policy, but it keeps the initiative with you. So you want to keep the initiative as much with the other person as possible. The fourth and final rule of monkey management is that we need to schedule a checkup exam. Even with healthy people, they need a medical checkup every once in a while, so that when are we going to check up on this next, so that we both know when that is. Now, the better somebody gets at handling responsibilities, the less frequent the checkup times are. So checkup combined with insurance policy together with ownership and next moves is a really nice strategy. And we're starting to use it in our company at meetings, which to say, okay, that agenda item, we finished with that, okay. Who's got the next move? Who owns it? Right. What's the latitude or freedom you have to act?
Right.
And when are we going to check up on that? Next week or next month? And the philosophy that Bill had was keeping this initiative always in the other person's court, even though he has some funny stuff. For example, when I'll say to you, well, give me a recommendation. See, and the next day, into my in-basket comes a recommendation, see, which is now, who's
the
got the next move?
You got
move?
The monkey now.
See, it's all. And so Bill said, well, the way you deal with that is I call you, Tony, and I said, I got your memo on that Anderson proposal. Why don't you come in and read it to me? See, and
said,
you'll
well,
say,
I could just tell you about it.
Yeah, probably in half the time,
right.
See. But now what I'm doing is I'm forcing that memo, rather than you sitting around waiting for me to read and react, is my reaction is, let's have a meeting. And at that meeting, I can keep the initiative in your court, where if my in-basket is full, 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 and everybody's out there waiting for me to respond, then I got a cage full of monkeys.
Yeah, you're the bottleneck, too. Then you're to blame when things aren't happening. That's interesting. I think most managers deal with that on a regular basis. They've got all these projects going, and they want to feel like they're in control, and they want to feel like they're in charge, and maybe you want to feel like they're irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. I know in the book you touched on that. I thought it was an interesting perspective. Maybe you could share that.
Well, I think that if you think that you're irreplaceable, that's the kind of person who ought to be replaced, because there's nothing worse than losing somebody, you know, who knows everything and nobody else does. And therefore, I think promotion should depend on your having a ready replacement to take your job. That's where you really are valuable.
So basically what you're saying is I think your synopsis of those four rules are, number one, you got to describe what we've got here is a monkey. What is the next move? What needs to be done? Two is you got to assign it. Three is you got to ensure it, which is your way of making sure the job's going to get done, the next move's going to happen, and that the initiative hopefully will be followed up on. And then fourthly is to give it a checkup. And I think those four are really powerful. Let's take a real life example for people. Give me an example outside of business. How can we use these four, let's say, with our kids or in a relationship? Can you think of a context or an example we might be able to utilize for people?
Well, suppose your kid comes home and says, "Mom, Dad, I made the Little League." You know,
oh, great,
you know. So the kid says, "But I need a ride to practice and to games." And typical parent response immediately is, "Well, gee, you know, I think I could take you on Monday and Wednesday, but I don't know about that. Well, who's on the team? Maybe I can set up a carpool and all." And all of a sudden, the kid is just baiting you and setting you up. And here, what was a celebration is now a huge monkey or almost gorilla as you got to deal with the whole carpool. And here's this kid that's on the phone all the time anyway. And why not to say, you know, congratulations? And then the kid says, "I need a ride." Well, gee, this is a real opportunity. What? To keep initiative in his. It's all right for you to say, you know, "I think I could take you Monday afternoon and Wednesday. In fact, I'd enjoy that, but I don't see how I can do it any other time. What do you think would be the best way to get other rides?" "Well, gee, I don't know." "Well, maybe you can't be on the team." "Well, I don't know. Maybe we can't." "Well, you know who's on the team. How are you going to do that, you know?" And now what you're doing is you're doing what you can do that you feel good about, but now you're starting a process for to say, well, how could he set up his own carpool and how could he do that? I mean, because now the responsibility is going there rather than he racing in to watch TV while suddenly you're on the phone with this great monkey. And what happens is that kids and other people don't realize you do it, but when you make somebody dependent, what you're really doing is you're just sapping out their own self-esteem and their own power, where if you can teach people even a simple thing of getting themselves a ride. We used to say with Scott and Debbie, you know, "We'd be happy to take you or pick you up, but we'll never go two ways. If you can't talk some other parent into taking you one way, then you stay home." You know,
good rule.
So almost anything that happens, you can say, "Aha, here's an opportunity." It's an opportunity for people to take initiative. Now, is it appropriate that I take the initiative, or is it appropriate that I help them take the initiative? And as much as possible, if you can teach people to be responsible for their own conditions, their own place in life, then they're going to really feel powerful. But dependency, I worry about the suicide rate in this country, and I think a lot of it, you know, as you read, coming from, quote, good families and all, is that people get rescued tremendously now. You're not holding kids accountable.
Right.
But I think that's making people realize that there are some consequences to your behavior, not that you bail out on them, but that you help them own them. It's not yours.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, keeping the initiative there is so critical. One time I sat down with my second youngest, Joshua, and he was, I think, 8 at the time. We were discovering what his rules were, because we all seem to have rules, whether we're aware of it or not, for how people should be and what they should do or not do. And one of the rules he had for moms was that moms shouldn't do everything for their sons. And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because one day mom won't be there, and that son will have to be able to do things for himself." And
that's
if he doesn't
powerful.
Do it, he said, "If he doesn't learn now, he won't know then." And I think that's really true. I'll never forget him saying that. We have to give people the opportunity to learn now, because one of the things I loved about in the book was the metaphor you might share with of kids today being bored, or what parents do in sports today, because I related to that very powerfully personally. I thought it was pretty interesting when you talked about what it was to organize a sports team back in those days. You might relate that. I really enjoyed that a lot.
Well, I think those are the kind of examples that I really love about the 1 Minute Manager Meets the Monkey, because we're trying to give examples that people get them in the gut level. And I was just relating how we pretty well, you know, organized, got the equipment, got the kids, got the thing, set up games, all ourselves. We did all the planning, organizing, motivating, and all. Nowadays, the kids, you know, who does it? The parents, you know, all the kids today got to do is get dressed. And they all look like, you know, superstars and that kind of thing. And And they get driven to the game. You know, you wouldn't want them to get any exercises. We have these big diamonds with parents sweating, you know, getting hot dogs and hamburgers out because you don't want the kids to go hungry. And people in the stands with major league scoreboards filling them out, you know, and just a lot of craziness. So we've created boredom. I mean, kids don't know what to do if there's not a lesson this afternoon or it's not a required thing. And when I was a kid, if I said to my mom, I'm bored, she'd go, womp, or, you know, how's that for a little boredom? Or she'd say, all right, go in and do the garage, yeah, clean out the garage.
I'll put you to work if you're bored.
And where I think what happens is if you keep on taking initiative away from people, then when they get away from Big Daddy or Big Mommy, who are going to do it all for them, and they get caught doing inappropriate things, they don't have any internal way to deal with that. And I think there's where you get the suicides and the depressions and all that, because suddenly the outside world is going to hold you accountable.
And you have no strategies on how to organize yourself
to
make things happen.
And so what we need to do is teach people how to fish rather than giving them a fish. And I look at that, you know, even in a foreign policy. We have never made a long-term friend where we've gone in and owned all the problems, shoved all kinds of money, and not taught them any skills.
Right.
In the long run, they just tell us to go and all, where if you went in and said, okay, what we want to do is teach you
how to manage your monkeys.
Yeah.
That's in essence what has to happen.
I mean, here we are with a whole southern neighborhood that aren't big fans of ours. Why? Because we haven't done anything to help them solve their problems, but dump money in and act like we're Big Daddy or Big Mom.
The same thing in Eastern Europe now, you know, too.
That's right. The people I remember most, teachers and all, were the people who pushed me to be the best that I can, stretched me, and yeah. I ended up saying, wow, I did that, you know. And what's the old Chinese phrase? The greatest leader of them all is when the job is done, the people say we did it ourselves. And I think that's what The Woman at Manager Meets the Monkey is about, is don't own a problem if it's not yours, but how do you help people care and feed monkeys so they get empowered, they get strong and all. And I think it frees you up tremendously to do the things that are really important for you to do rather than taking a briefcase home every night of other people's monkeys and they're all sitting around wondering if you'll ever get to their folder.
Yeah. What are some of the hooks? I loved your metaphor that you talked about in there of the idea that your notepad is like a giant crane lifting monkeys off other people's backs and putting them on your own. Mm. What are some of the hooks that we have out there? What are some of the phrases we should listen for to avoid picking up other people's monkeys? Do you have any clues there?
Well, we is a big one.
Yeah.
When anybody says we, there's a wonderful dialogue in there where the guy comes with his boss, we have a monkey, and the guy says, look, let's clean up the pronouns. He said, first of all, we have never had a problem. Either you have a problem or I have a problem. If it's your problem, I'm willing to help you with it.
Right.
And if it's mine, I might need some help from you. But we will never have a problem. So we is a really big one.
Right.
And I think the whole concept of in basket and out basket is just, it's a whole chain of monkeys traveling around an organization. And I think if people, rather than sending people memos, would get up out of their seat and walk down the hall and talk to somebody, then they could legitimately decide the next moves and that kind of thing. I think we just get caught in our managing our in basket and
right.
our out basket rather than managing people and situations.
How do we manage our own monkeys more effectively? What's the best way to attack the challenges we've got?
Well, I think the first one is to prioritize them because, you know, there are a lot of monkeys around, but some of them you ought to let starve. You know, not all of them are worth keeping alive.
That's great.
And so we need to separate out our jungle.
Right.
So to say, which ones am I going to focus my time and energy on? Because if you try to be all things to all people and to try to do everything, you are going to burn yourself out. There's two real extremes in life. One is burnout, and burnout comes from lack of completion, lack of feedback and satisfaction on a whole bunch of, you're just racing around like somebody. And the other is rust out. my wife Marge talks about that all the time, where you just don't have enough to do. And
right.
Since we are purposeful beings, we really need to set some goals. And so all people ought to look at, okay, where would I like to be in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and say, okay, which monkeys are most important to me? Where are they? And don't beat yourself up for monkeys that you're not dealing with that maybe are ones that you shouldn't.
What would you say is the most important thing that the one-minute manager meets the monkey will give someone? What's the promise of this book? If you're going to, I know you've given us a lot of promises, but what's the essence for you?
Well, I think it's the best weight loss program probably in history because you're guaranteed to lose 30 pounds overnight because you get rid of some of these monkeys. So I think it's a chance to feel empowered yourself because I think we get bogged down and feel guilty and feel like we're not being helpful and how come, like, God, I mean, these people are waiting for my answers and all this kind of thing. So I think the biggest payoff is it increases your self-esteem as well as the people you're dealing with. It increases the people you're dealing with self-esteem because they start to feel good because they learn how to care and feed their own monkeys and they start to feel their own power. It increases yours because you feel good about their growth and you also now can put some of your discretionary time, which you have lost, into projects and goals and areas that are going to really be empowering and exciting for you.
You mentioned earlier that you went on this trip last fall to 18 countries with your family, and I know that was a long-time goal for you, and it's pretty phenomenal to be able to do that because you're the major person, you're the head of your own organization, and yet you've managed to do that. Was the one-minute manager meets the monkey, was that philosophy a foundation for you taking that time out and making that trip happen?
I think it really helped us really see that we could do that, and I think it was also a way that we could take another step to say to our management team, particularly Marge's management team, because she really manages the place more than I do, that we felt good enough to just let them run with the ball. And we, you know, said we don't want faxes rolling in our room every night.
In Africa, that's kind of tough, huh?
I think it made them feel good and us feel good. To the point where we have moved from a two-person organization where everything was dependent on us to an organization where people really see their own destiny tied in and not all sitting around waiting for me.
Right. What did you learn on that trip? Are there any particular distinctions or strategies? I know when I go to a movie or when I listen to a record or I get a chance to have a conversation like this with a friend, I always pull away some gems, and I'm sure you did too. Is there any particular gem, strategy, idea, or distinction you had on this trip that was valuable?
I think sometimes whether things are learnings or relearnings, but the biggest aha that came so clear to me was that the problems in the world today are not technological. They're all human. I mean, we flew into Johannesburg, South Africa, one of the most modern, beautiful cities. We left there and went to Australia where the pilots have immobilized the country. We flew from there to Ireland and met wonderful people in a beautiful country, and yet they have people killing each other. And I mean, they're all human problems. Rabbi Kushner did kind of a prayer breakfast, and he said, you know, a lot of people say, you know, why believe in God or some external spirit and all that? And he said that the best way you can describe it is when we put a man on the moon several decades ago, every television set in our country was on that. The second moon landing, if you were home, you watched, and if you weren't, you didn't. The third moon landing, they had to play golf on the moon to get any interest. And he said, you know, we get bored by things made by man. He said, but how many of you get bored by a beautiful sunset or the sound of a sparkling brook or things like that? And I think we've gotten kind of taken into believe that technology is everything. And as I went around, the big aha is, I tell you, we got tremendous technical skills, but we need to shore up our human skills. And Marge and I came back recommitted and excited about the field that we have chosen, which is how do you help people enhance their human relations and their interaction with people? Because if we don't do that, we could destroy ourselves in the midst of the most unbelievable technological understandings that we have. And that, so that was a big aha. And you see what's happened in the Eastern Bloc and all. That those are all human issues. And there's a wonderful spirit in the world now. And I think there's a real place for personal development and organizational development and leadership development. And I feel really blessed to be in this field, both teaching and learning at the same time, because I think we now can make a real difference. But we gotta, you know, feel good about what we've done technologically, but to realize that the big payoff for survival and continual growth of the human species is our ability to listen, to love, to care, and to support each other.
That's wonderful. Ken, what do you think is the key to really enjoying what you do in life?
I think enjoyment is a choice. And I think that we as human beings, if we have choices by what we do, that we ought to go with things that bring us joy and bring us excitement, and then that will bring it to other people. But it's a real choice. And if you're not enjoying what you're doing, well, then don't do it. I mean, one of my favorite stories along this line that's really helped me in all my traveling or whatever I do is Beverly Sills was giving a concert in San Francisco one time, and she did it in the afternoon, and they had a reception for her, and a reporter from one of the San Francisco papers came up and said, "Miss Sills, I bet you hate the fact you have to give another concert tonight." And she said, "I don't have to give another concert tonight." He said, "What do you mean you don't have to? It's right here in the paper. It's 8 o'clock tonight." Mm-hmm. She said, "I don't have to give another concert. I get to give another concert tonight." She said, "For a long time, I used to be into this I have to, and I felt my energy get drained.
Right.
And one day, I realized that thousands of people were going around getting babysitters and getting dressed to come hear me sing, and I get to do this." And I think that enjoyment comes from getting in touch with it. You get to do that. And as I've said before, as a human being, we can make choices. I asked Norman Vincent Peale, why would the Lord give us free will? I mean, a lot of people I know, I wouldn't give him free will. And so he said, the reason the Lord did that is to make you strong. And I said, what do you mean make you strong? He said, well, it's just like building your muscles. You don't go into the gym and go in and get 1 pound weights and just build your muscles up, or you don't go by taking 400 pounds and trying to lift it. He said, you grow by resistance. And he said, since we can choose everything and we can make our lives nothing and meaningless, he said, the real growth comes from, and the strength comes from, resisting avenues that will take you off of purpose, will take you into things where you don't have skills or capabilities, and that the choice is powerful, and to recognize you have that, and then when you make that, be with that choice with all the energy and thought you have. And if you can't do that, then hey, you ought to do something else.
Yeah.
And some people
say,
chances
on the next spinning planet.
Well, you know, some people say, well, you know, if you have money, you have those opportunities. I want to tell you, everybody has that opportunity, because what's the worst that could happen is that you end up dancing in the street. So I think people in every situation can make choices. And there are people I know with millions and millions and millions of dollars who are really sad human beings who have no sense of purpose. And I've known people who came from poverty, who came with joy and made that. So it's a tremendous choice. And don't sort of say, well, this is that and that caused that and all. Hey, it's a choice. And I think enjoying what you do is a choice.
That's fabulous. So where does the one-minute manager go from here? I mean, you covered management, weight loss, you've dealt with monkeys.
Well, I'm working on a book now called Funny Business with Mark Goodman and Joel Goodman. They're not related. Mark is a freelance writer in New York I went to school with, and Joel Goodman was a graduate student of mine and is one of the top people in the country on humor. And we're writing a book called Funny Business, Taking Yourself Lightly and Your Job Seriously, and because I think we need more humor.
Yeah.
And I'm also working on a book called The One-Minute Manager Makes Money, because I think a lot of people a lot of people get hung up on what it takes to make money. And a wonderful entrepreneur friend of mine, Sheldon Bowles, who had all kinds of businesses in Canada, really got me on this and got all excited. And there's only three secrets to making money. The first one is you got to have fun to make money, and that right. gets that choice. And second secret is that sometime making money has to be more important than having fun. Because you can have fun making one painting,
right.
but you know, at some point you have to figure a way that maybe somebody might want to buy those so that you
right.
can. And then the third secret is that profit is a result of sales minus expenses. A lot of people, they think they should increase profits by putting all their energy on cutting expenses. And while that's necessary to stay in business, it's a demotivating. And what people need to do is find out how to use energy to increase sales, to create interest in what you're doing.
That's neat.
I hope that we'll get opportunities to influence the major leaders of the world, because I think if we could get the leaders of the world to understand some of the things that you and I are teaching, that it could make their lives and all. Because one of the other things I got in our 18-country tour was that there are fabulous human beings in
yeah.
the world, and it's only the lack of self-esteem and the egos of leaders that get into getting that energy going in the wrong direction. And how can we help people who have the potential to influence and lead feel good enough about themselves that their leadership is empowerment rather than control?
That's fabulous. Well, Ken, I appreciate you taking the time to share with us all the things that you've shared again. I appreciate your friendship most of all. I'm excited about us sharing the kinds of gems that you've packed into this session so that people have something they can count on every month as just another trigger, something that they can think about that maybe they could apply immediately and increase the quality of their life. And you've gone well beyond what anybody would imagine. But I'd say the thing that I respect about you most is that you walk your talk. That of all the people that I know, and I have the good fortune of knowing some pretty incredible people like you, there aren't any like you. They broke the mold with you, Ken. And your true caring, everything you've talked about here, I want people to know you live it. And sometimes when you read a book, you wonder whether the author lives it, but you live it so far beyond anybody I know. It's incredible. So it's my privilege to have you as a friend and be able to have the relationship we do, and I'm glad that people here will get a chance to hear a little of the inside of what really makes you who you are, and that is the giver. And it was once said that your work is love made visible, and I think the person saying it must have been talking about you. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's just always a joy to be with you.
Thanks.